This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. Today, we welcome back Bruce Cockburn. This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. I'd like to welcome back Bruce Cockburn. Great to see you.
Great to be with you again.
Yeah. Good to have you here. We should tell listeners right away we're doing this interview backstage at the Wilma Theater in Missoula in Bruce's green room. It's a little gray, but we'll...
It has a greenish tinge to it.
It does have a greenish tinge to it.
Most of them don't, actually.
As I was mentioning before we started the interview, it's been you've been on a couple different times, once with my former co-host Brian Copper, and also we did a phone interview, and that we're saying that goes back over at least a couple decades. So it's been too long. It's great to
I'll second that.
Yeah, great to have you in Montana as we were recording this. BruceCoburn.com is the name of his website, BruceCoburn.com. And Crowing Ignites is the most recent recording. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, as well as a lot of things, Bruce Coburn. Bruce, let's just dive right in and talk about this most recent recording. And I fully confess, I had forgotten that you had put this out. And so I did a quick, you know, dive in this morning and just absolutely love it. Let's talk about how this came about a little bit, and another instrumental album. I know a little bit about this story, but fill us in.
Yeah, well, we did an album a few years ago called Speechless, which was a compilation of previously recorded instrumental tracks with a few new ones added. And that turned out to be quite popular and well-received. And we'd been thinking, we being me and my manager, had sort of been talking in a casual way about maybe doing another instrumental album sometime. That's the same idea, because there was a lot of material left over that wasn't on that album, and then other things were recorded since and that could be on a new one. And so we were going to do Speechless 2. And so with that in mind, I started coming up with instrumental pieces to have some new material to put on it. And then the ideas just kept coming, and all of a sudden we had so much new stuff that the album took on its own life. So instead of being a sequel to anything, it's itself, it's Crowing Ignites, and not Speechless 2.
Let me ask you this. With instrumental music, how do those ideas come to you? The obvious thing that people would think of is you actually have an instrument in your hands.
Yeah.
I mean, is that pretty much it? Or is there times when melodies come? I've talked to musicians recently who literally have melodies come into dreams, and then they try to replicate them.
That's happened to me once or twice over the decades, but it's not the common thing. And with instrumental music especially, it comes out of playing the guitar. I mean, with lyrics, of course, with a song with lyrics, I might start writing lyrics without an instrument around. I might have a rhythm in my head that the lyrics, you know, that'll give the lyrics some sort of shape. But with an instrumental piece, they come from fooling around on the guitar, mostly from practicing, from exploring, from sort of saying, well, what happens if I take this chord formation and I put it over there and reverse this finger and that finger, and you just try things and see what comes out. And sometimes what comes out is a motif that can be expanded into an actual composition, and so that's the story of most of the pieces on the new album. There are two exceptions to that, which are longer pieces that were improvised in the studio, based on concepts that I went in with. So I have a fairly large collection of singing bowls, and I wanted to use them. I love the sound, and I can't play them myself on stage because I'm too busy playing the guitar. So here was a chance to kind of do something with that. And so we laid down a couple of layers of singing bowls and a couple of other things, some orchestral chimes and some, you know, a few bits and pieces of other stuff. And that became a piece called Bells of Gethsemane. But the other pieces on the album were kind of composed beforehand, and so it was a question of just going in and playing them. Thank you.
Bruce Cockburn joining us here on Musicians Spotlight. Bruce, I want to ask you about the memoir. You're at least the third musician I've spoken to who's had written a memoir. I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago that I'd interviewed Ani DiFranco recently. Mm-hmm. Of course, she has one. I know I interviewed Sean Colvin at a certain point, not long after she had written one. Can you just talk about what that process was like to dive into that, and then how that, I know that there's a little bit of a story as to how that affected your songwriting a little bit, or how you saw it.
Well, yeah, it I had resisted invitations to do that previously. Over the years, every now and then somebody would turn up and go, okay, well, we'd like you to write a memoir, we'll publish it, and blah, blah, blah. Or people would come up and say, I'd like to write the authorized biography, how about it? And it always seemed, in that case, it seemed like, no, it's my story to tell. If anybody's going to write it, it should be me. And then, but it always seemed too soon. But at one point, Harper Collins came along and said, you know, we're interested in having you do a memoir. And they were interested partly because memoirs became a thing, right? Everybody's writing memoirs. And partly because I think there was a book called The Shack that was a huge bestseller. It's a Christian novel, very explicitly Christian, and I get referenced in it a lot. Mm. And it sold, like, I don't know, 150 million copies or some stunning number of books. I don't know, I'm making up the figure, but it was a very large number, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. So I think that they looked at that and they thought, maybe we should get this guy to write a memoir. And I think they were disappointed, actually. But they certainly acted like they were. They presented me with the suggestion that I write a spiritual memoir. And I said, well, what is that? What's a spiritual memoir? Well, we don't know, but you're going to come up with it, was the answer. So, okay, well, I'm game, you know. And they, to put it in perspective, they made a generous offer as well. I mean, that, you know, it just a combination of that, of the fact that they appeared to be genuinely interested, and the timing, because I felt like at this point I was at an age where I had a story to tell. Hmm. You know, I mean, you can find coffee table books that, you know, a 30-year-old hockey player's memoirs,
yeah,
you know, with pictures, or, you know, a teenage rock star with the story of her life, right? And, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I never wanted to be part of that world. But by the time this thing came along, I felt like I'd been around long enough to have something to say. So I started bravely into it, and I got about 100 pages in, and it was actually flowing along pretty well. Talking about early childhood and the very distant memories was easy. But as soon as I kind of got close to adulthood, where life becomes more complicated and where some of the witnesses are still alive and might be mm-hmm. compromised, etc., mm-hmm. it became very complicated, and I got stuck. I didn't know what to do. So I enlisted a co-writer, which was a friend of mine named Greg King, who's a journalist in California. And he initially, I hired him to interview me at length on the tour bus after shows. We'd be get on the bus, and I'd have had a couple of drinks and probably be having another one, and he would engage me in conversation and record all this, and we got, you know, a lot of good stuff out of that. And you know, so I had that to work with. But then when I got him to be the co-writer, those things stood us in good stead. I sort of elevated him to that position when I realized that I was just not going to, I didn't know where to go next with this. Mm. You know, how do you make a complicated life into a story when the memories are as complex as they are? Like, it's great when they're simple graphic ones, like what you remember from your childhood. But you know, or if the memoir was specific, like Patti Smith's memoir or others that where you're dealing with a very limited time frame, then you can just go after that. And that would have been an easier task. But to tell a whole life story of my relationship with God, you know, in a in a
easy to digest form.
Well, in a comprehensible form. Yeah. Never mind easy to digest.
Right, I mean, right.
The reader can decide if it's easy to digest or not. But it was a daunting task anyway. But we got it done, and I'm very pleased with how it came out. So, and where that you asked about that relative to songwriting, and what happened there was that during the 4 years basically that it took to get the book written, I didn't write any songs because all the creative energy and any ideas I had were going into the book. So at the end of that time, I'm sort of sitting there going, well, am I still a songwriter or am I, a wielder of prose now or something, right? So fortunately, I turned out to be a songwriter still.
You got lamentation, you got dislocation, you got sirens wailing and the walls come down. You got revelation, you got felt relation, door creaks open and the trumpets sound. We're taking it.
This is John Floridus. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight, and I'm speaking today with Bruce Cockburn. Bruce, I wanted to ask you about something I'm sure that comes up all the time when you have a, 50-year career at this point?
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
about exactly.
Honestly, I don't mean to make light of it by laughing. I'm just like, kind of, it's so incredible to have that kind of substance. The concept of revisiting earlier material, I mean, when you have the material that is so precious, so special to the audience members. And I'm thinking, how do you even begin to address trying to balance out what you want to do as a musician with newer material, but also trying to, honor that kind of connection you've made over the years,
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a balancing act, but it's not actually that hard, I don't find it. Maybe because I'm just restless enough by nature that it's my own inclination to keep moving on regardless. But I do respect and really seriously appreciate people's attachment to those older songs. I wouldn't be I wouldn't have been able to sustain what I'm doing without that attention and attachment. But if I only did that, those people would become fewer and fewer in number over time. Mm-hmm. People would get tired of hearing the same old thing. Oh yeah, well we heard them last year and it was the same as the year before, etc. You can't offer people that and expect them to stay interested, even though they think that's what they want sometimes. Most people are, in at least my experience with my audience, is that they're also a little bit adventurous and they want to hear new things. Mm-hmm. And I mean, sometimes people will yell out requests for something new, you know. And I sometimes I have something new, sometimes I don't. But but it's nice to get asked, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's for me. I can't remember more than about 50 or 60 songs at a time. Of the maybe 300 or so that I've recorded.
That's good to say.
So, you know, I mean, if I want to do an old song that I haven't played for a long time, I've got to go back and relearn it. And sometimes that's easy, sometimes it's not, because some of the guitar parts are kind of complicated and I have a hard time, I would have a hard time relearning them off the record myself.
Well, the thing that hits me when I go to one of your shows is, it's not just Wondering Where the Lions Are or If I Had a Rocket Launcher. It's All the Diamonds. You know, these are the kinds of songs. People go deep. You know, the folks that have been, you know, moved and touched by your music for all these years, I mean, they go deep into, you know, we call the album cuts. At a Bruce Cockburn show, it's not necessarily the ones that they've heard the most on the radio or something.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, over the decades, it's a relatively small number of songs that have been widely exposed on radio. So, you know, there are people who want to hear those for sure. But as you say, people are attached to songs. I mean, the album, All the Diamonds in the World, was on an album called Salt, Sun, and Time. Almost no one bought that back in the day. I mean, it was the worst selling album I'd made to date at that time. And so, you know, I mean, I don't concern myself very much with that kind of statistic, but it was noticeable. And but over time, you know, that song has really stuck, and people are glad to hear that whenever it comes out. There's a few others, Pacing the Cage. There's one like that on an album that Pacing the Cage didn't get on the radio much. Certain songs just seem to hit people where they live in some way, and it's not something I have much control over. I mean, you always want to do that, of course. That's what the whole point is to communicate and share experience and feelings with people. And but certain songs just seem to be to strike that sort of chord, so to speak, and therefore stand out from the rest.
Sunset is an angel weeping, holding out a bloody sword. No matter how I squint, I cannot make out what it's pointing toward. Sometimes you feel like you've lived too long. Days drip slowly. Catch yourself pacing the cage. I've proven who I am so many times. The magnetic strips worn thin, and each time I was someone else. Everyone was taken in. Powers chatter in high places, stir up eddies in the dust of rage. Set me to pacing the cage. Thank you. spells that I could say. It's as if the thing were written in the constitution of the age. Sooner or later, you'll end up pacing the cage. Sometimes the best map will not guide you. You can't see what's round the bend. Sometimes the road leads through dark places. Sometimes the darkness is your friend. Today these eyes scan land for the coming of the outbound stage. Pacing the cage. Pacing the cage.
We'll be back with more Musicians Spotlight and our visit with Bruce Cockburn. Welcome back to Musicians Spotlight and our visit with Bruce Cockburn.
I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. Heading for, heading for, heading for the city of God. Standing on the platform, awed by the power I feel. A hand upon my shoulder saying, brother, climb aboard. I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. Heading for, heading for, heading for the city of God. Standing on the platform, the locomotive throbbing, I'm drawn. Wonder of a child's heart, I'm stepping up the stair. I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. I'm on the Jesus train. Heading for, heading for, heading for the city of God. heading for the city of God.
Bruce Coburn joining us here on Musician Spotlight. I want to tell listeners again, we're recording this interview backstage at the Wilma Theater. And so if you hear little extemporaneous sounds going on every once in a while, that's what's going on. We're backstage in the greenish gray room.
Yes. It's...
It matches your sweater, by the way, but give a little bit.
Yeah. I think the sweater is a German Army surplus sweater, and the walls certainly, you know, you could imagine yourself in a trench here. In this,
as we record this on Veterans Day here in the United States. Bruce, I mentioned we had some questions from folks who follow the program on Facebook. This one comes from Hannah from the Flathead Valley up here just north of Missoula. And speaking of tunes from past albums, she wants to know, who would be the person you'd want to have champagne with now if it was the last night of the world?
Oh, boy. My wife.
Good answer.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Now, here's another one, also from the Flathead Valley. This comes from the Facebook page. What is the best advice you've ever been given?
Boy, there's a lot of, I mean, in what area of life, you know? Sit down and shut up was a pretty good piece of advice. I had on many occasions when I was young. It's hard to put quotation marks around a particular piece of advice that had an effect, but lots. I mean, I somehow learned to pay attention to what's around me, to pay attention to people. It didn't come necessarily willingly, because I kind of tend to be kind of self-absorbed, as a lot of people who do creative stuff are. But I think I got some of that from my dad, and some of it from teachers I had. As far as a practical music business advice, the best piece of advice I ever had was, don't sell your publishing.
It's a wide range of good advice you've been getting.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's because if you think about a whole life, you know, it would be the same for everybody. You can get advice about your business, or advice about your education, or advice about this and that. But the advice that matters most is the advice of how to be a good human being. I don't know if I can remember anybody telling me a particularly pithy bit that helped me become whatever I am that passes for a good human being. That's my phone telling me it's time for something. Probably the interview that we're doing. I'm sorry I don't have a more, you know, succinct answer for that one. But
Wendy from Missoula asks, I like this one. Can you recall and share any moments of your childhood? Maybe this is already covered in the memoir. I don't know. I should have mentioned the memoir is called Rumors of Glory, correct?
Right. That's correct. Yeah.
Can you recall or share any moments of your childhood that sparked your sense of awe and wonder for the natural world, which she says is very evident in your music? I would agree with that.
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. My parents were always into being outdoors. I grew up in Ontario. Especially in that era, it was a place with four distinct seasons, and each of the seasons had something to offer in terms of outdoor involvements. So we skied in the winter and we canoed in the summer and all that sort of stuff. When I got old enough, I went to summer camp in a provincial park in Ontario, a wilderness area where there was a real emphasis on canoe tripping. And so I'd spend chunks of the summer out in actual wilderness, you know, in the company of fellow campers and staff. But I really acquired a love for that atmosphere. When I think of nature, I still picture those lakes and rocks and trees of the Canadian Shield terrain. Later on, having had that kind of basis, I in the early 70s, I did a lot of traveling across Canada by road and spent as much time as possible in the Rockies, where there was this incredible inspirational landscape that invited you to get into it and explore. But it was, I think, just early exposure to that stuff that set the stage for appreciating it later when I was kind of more aware of what I was looking at and being in. Mm-hmm. But there's always been a sense of, aside from the sense of space, of the uncluttered nature of, even though actual nature is really cluttered with all sorts of details, it presents a simple face compared to urban life. And even as a teenager or before, I appreciated that. And the sense of space and the sense of there being a kind of spiritual reality that was more evident in that atmosphere than in the hallways of school, for instance.
Bruce, Mike from Missoula asks this: with songs like Call It Democracy and your focus on injustice and suffering in the world and activism over the years, how are you keeping it together in these days? I mean, it probably could be like any days, but he's asking specifically
well,
these days.
Yeah, so, we all have our reasons for looking at these days with horror.
Yeah.
But how am I keeping it together? I don't know. I'm not sure I am keeping it together, but I'm older, for one thing, my own personal investment in the future is limited, but I have a young daughter, and I'm very concerned about her welfare, her future welfare, and I think about the world that we're handing her generation. She's about to turn 8, and you know, that the world we're handing that generation, we're not giving them any gift there. And that's disturbing as all get out. So, you know, I don't know what we can do about any of this stuff. I mean, the political scene is both a cause and a spinoff from a broader sense of entropy kind of enveloping the world, like that because that the bizarre politics of America right now are reflected everywhere else you look in the world too.
Yes, I mean,
it's going on all over the place. The same themes, and the same sort of devaluing of community and of the notion of democracy, of what democracy meant to me as a kid when I was being taught what that was. That's all under attack, and I'm kind of attached to that notion of democracy. I'd like to see it not collapse, and other people are willing to give it up, but for various reasons. But you know, fortunately, there's I think a lot of us that don't want to give it up, and maybe we'll carry the day, maybe we won't. But in any case, we've got a litany of problems that we're going to have to be contending with, and you know, we can't turn our back on it without paying a terrible price.
Of power, here they come, international loan sharks backed by the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and his brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity by turning countries into labor camps. Modern slavers and dragons, champions of freedom. Sinister, cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny, a so-called developed nation's idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying fuck about the people in misery. IMF, dirty MF, takes away everything you can get. Always making certain that there's one thing left. Keep them on the hook with insupportable debt. See the paid off local bottom feeders passing themselves off as leaders. Kiss the ladies, shake hands with the fellows, and it's open for business like a cheap bordello. And they call it democracy. 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 See the loaded eyes of the children too, trying to make the best of it the way kids do. One day you're gonna rise from your habitual feast and find yourself staring down the throat of the beast they call a revolution. IMF, dirty MF, takes away everything you can get. Always making certain that there's one thing. Insupportable debt. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy.
Bruce, here's a little easier one. Maybe not easier, but maybe a little gentler question. Your favorite movie?
Oh, yeah. Kill Bill, maybe. Would be a contender. Right. There have been a few, actually, over the years. But I generally lean toward violence and stuff. Actually, I mean, I say that, it's kind of true, but it's also not the whole picture. Back in the day, I was a big fan of Ingmar Bergman's films. And when I see those movies now, they still stand up. They're wonderful works of art, especially because he was very late coming to the use of color. So most of his films are black and white, and they're so beautifully shot and lit and everything, and well acted and well written. And so the movies, I suppose, that stick in my mind are old ones like that. The movies from the 60s and 70s, Fellini's movies and Bergman's movies, the movies made by that generation of auteurs who really were not operating on Hollywood principles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's nothing wrong with Hollywood per se. I mean, well, there probably are several things wrong, but I mean, Hollywood makes good movies nonetheless.
Yeah, you started with Kill Bill, also.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Hollywood's capable of making very good movies, and some of those have been powerful movies. HUD was back in, you know, the Paul Newman movie from long ago is a great movie, and you know, there's always it's. I pay less attention to movies now than I did because of having a young family, and I don't get out much anymore, right? So, except for when I'm on tour, and then I'm busy. But I love movies as an art form. A movie that stayed with me forever. I talked about this in the book, was Polanski's Repulsion. And almost anything by Polanski, actually, that isn't true. Half of Polanski's stuff is really great. Some of it's not so great. But Chinatown is a classic, wonderful movie, sure, for instance. And those movies speak a kind of truth. Even Kill Bill, in a way. I mean, it's really not what I would turn to for that sort of inspiration. But there's the way characters show up and the angles that you're invited to see life from by those characters are worthwhile when they're good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like just tossing out there that a lot of these movies involve violence, because it's not something maybe somebody would have thought stereotypically, but the darkness has to go somewhere, Bruce.
Yeah.
So why not go to your movies? I'm the same.
I mean,
way,
I've sat through movies that were way too violent for my tastes. I mean, the violence in a movie like Kill Bill is comic book violence. It's the implications of it are horrifying, but we don't really think about the implications because it's the same with the Mad Max movies. I had a day off in Philadelphia a couple of tours ago, and we went to see the latest Mad Max thing, whatever it's called, and it's just a bunch of crazy vehicles racing across a desert. But they tried to pay lip service to sort of feminism in that movie, and it didn't really work very well. But it was interesting. Yeah. It made for a more interesting movie in the Mad Max line, right? Because there were some women in it that were actually doing something instead of just being exploited and harassed. But that movie, what stuck in my mind about that movie was how loud it was. I've never sat through anything as loud as that. But it was fun. And that, on that level, the violence is just stupid. It's a stupid. By stupid, I mean it's stupid the way drinking beer and watching, the professional wrestling is stupid. Like, it's entertaining as can be for the people that like that. So, that works for me. But if I want substance, then, I wouldn't go there looking for substance.
Mm.
But you do find that in... most of my references are old movies, but now, because I don't get to see the new ones very often. But I wonder if people are still making movies like that. Once in a while, you read about something that's come out that because I keep track of movies by reading reviews and synopses and whatnot. But I wonder, you know, who's out there doing the really meaningful stuff right now.
Bruce Coburn joining us here on Musician's Spotlight. One more question to kind of wrap things up. What are you doing for fun? This is kind of one of my stock wrap-up questions. But, you know, outside of, you've mentioned you have a young child, you've got mm-hmm. Family life back there in the Bay Area, and you're on tour, maybe some stuff that you're doing in between all that.
There's not much in between, I'm afraid.
Catch some really more Bergman movies.
Yeah, well, I don't even get a chance to watch TV or anything at this point. It's been a long time since I sat and watched a whole movie, other than on a plane. But I don't really do anything for recreation at this point. I miss that, actually, because I miss having. I used to do a lot of sitting around, wondering what I was going to do next. You know, and I miss that, frankly, because I don't get to do that now at all. When I'm at home, I get my daughter to school in the morning, and I pick her up at around 5 o'clock. She has after school programs that she does, and in between, I get to do the things I do. And at the age I'm at, half of those things are appointments with doctors and whatever, and then the other half are just mundane things that have to get done. And And I try to fit some practicing in there and all that. So I'll tell you how I have fun. On Sunday mornings, I go to a particular church and I sit in with the band. And I jam on electric guitar with, you know, with the church band. And I have fun when I'm actually performing. This tour, we're doing a duo thing. It's my nephew and I playing together. And he's playing guitar and accordion, and he's brought a really great thing to the music, and we have a lot of fun.
Crowing Ignites is the most recent instrumental recording. Mm-hmm. And so that's one I want folks to take a listen to. And it's Bone on Bone, correct? Is the one...
The one before that, right.
Which is Songs with Words.
Yes.
And BruceCoburn.com is the name of Bruce's website. Thank you so much for making time to visit with us here on Musician Spotlight. It's been a pleasure getting to chat with you and talk shop a little bit and find out a little bit more about what's going on in the world of Bruce.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your interest, and it's been an enjoyable conversation.
Thank you. This is John Floridis. You've been listening to Musicians Spotlight. Our guest today has been Bruce Coburn. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us online on Twitter and on Facebook. Our program is available as a podcast from those websites, as well as through iTunes. Special thanks to Logjam Presents for this interview. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.